Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the oil crash and you, right after this message. You know, when you're making $50,000 a year and you pay $7,650 in Social Security tax. In addition to that, you pay a 17% income tax on that same $50,000, and that's another $8,500. And you just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. You know, that makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%, not the 15.3% that's being advertised. Now, isn't that just special? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. Call and ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, go to the website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about this thing of central planning and nuclear energy. And I said that if nuclear energy were deregulated and you just left people alone, you'd solve your problem. Because, first of all, the greenies and the environmentalists are concerned about nuclear energy because of its great danger. Well, I don't know about great danger. So far as I know, there's only been one nuclear accident. That was a bad one over in Russia. Here in the United States, nobody's been killed in a nuclear power plant. Now, I was just reading the news the other day, and I noticed that 4,000 miners a year are killed over in China. 4,000 a year. We used to have death tolls like that mining coal underground here in the United States. Looked like to me that mining coal for coal-powered power plants, coal-fired power plants, kills more people and is a whole lot more hazardous to our health, safety, and welfare than nuclear power. But I'm informed here that nuclear power is totally unacceptable, and we have these lobbies. Lobbies. You got the coal lobby, the oil lobby, the nuclear lobby. You got all these lobbies, these special interest groups, and right now the oil lobby is in control of the government. The problem is that we're running out of oil. Well, at least that's what they keep telling us. Now, one of my listeners, a fellow by the name of Tate, sent me a treatise here on nuclear power and gas and solar and so on. And he said, you know, these oil guys have been lying to us. They tell us that they've got a lot more oil than there's really out there. And the thing that was so shocking about this report is that we're consuming oil at the rate of 22 billion barrels a year. 22 billion barrels a year, but we're only finding oil at the rate of 6 billion barrels a year. Now, you know, that isn't going to go on forever, is it? I didn't know that. My solution has been, now that we've let the genie out of the jar and we got central planning and regulation, that we ought to concentrate on nuclear power. America produces about 20% of its power from nuclear. 40% in Japan, 60% in France. And if we could do this in the United States, the nuclear people here tell us we'd need about 8,000 more power plants. 8,000 nuclear power plants. And God, that just scares the bejesus out of everybody, doesn't it? Well, everybody but me. I guess I'm not smart enough to figure out that I ought to be scared. And there's a couple, three reasons for that. Let me read to you some of the article here. They tell us that there was an abandoned reactor a mega dose of radioactivity, although it no longer contains its uranium fuel. The Trojan reactor vessel contains 15 times as much radioactivity as those objects, according to state officials, and it was shut down in 1993, 2 decades earlier than planned, after a series of problems, including a faulty safety system that drew federal fines, an accidental release of radioactive gases, and cracked steam tubes. Nearly 800 spent but highly radioactive uranium fuel rod assemblies removed from the reactors over the years remain in storage at the Trojan site. And this is being advanced now as a reason why we should not have nuclear energy. Excuse me? Let's think about this. Although it no longer contains its uranium fuel, the Trojan reactor vessel contains 15 times as much radioactivity as those objects, according to state officials. I say, so what? So what? Plutonium is a pretty nasty byproduct. Now, we got 14,000 nuclear weapons in the United States. There's another 14,000 over in Russia. We seem to be able to handle those all right. How come we can't handle a nuclear power plant and it's dirty? If you can handle it in nuclear weapons, then surely you must be able to handle it. If you can handle it, you can handle it here in a nuclear power plant, can't you? And if you can't, why? Why can't you solve that problem? They go on to say they closed this plant down in 1993, and I asked the question, why? Regulation. It became unprofitable 2 decades earlier than planned. Now, there's a nuclear power plant up in Eureka, California. Last I heard, it was still operating by PG&E. Whoever's operating it's still been there. It's been there. It's out there at Boone Point. Now, if that nuclear power plant's been there since 1954, is still operating up there, why don't we still operate these nuclear power plants forever? If a coal power plant can operate for 30, 50, or 75 years, how come a nuclear power plant can't? And then they go on to say, after a series of problems, including a faulty safety system. Well, if you got a faulty safety system, why don't you make a safe safety system? And it says it drew federal fines. Well, gosh, do you mean to tell me there are no federal fines on coal-fired power plants, gas-fired power plants, and oil-fired power plants? I mean, come on. Who cares about how many fines have been levied against the plant? Fix it, and let's get on with life. Next, an accidental release of radioactive gases and cracked steam tubes. Okay, well, why don't we fix the cracked steam tubes? Why don't we replace the steam tubes if they're cracked? I mean, this is juvenile. You know, if you have a cracked block in your car, you throw the car away, or do you replace the head? I mean, Jesus, I read this kind of crap all the time, you know, and I say to myself, are these people the kind of people who have PhDs and have been to college, for crying out loud? And they come up with these kinds of lame brain objections to this technology? We can run ships around the world with nuclear power plants, but we can't run one sitting on land that's standing still, for crying out loud? And then I go on to say here, nearly 800 spent but highly radioactive uranium fuel rod assemblies removed from the reactor over the years remain in storage at the Trojan site. Okay, so what? Every nuclear plant in the country is storing the nuclear waste on site. They've been doing that now for 50 years. Somebody woke up one day and said, well, we got to solve that problem, and they came up with a mountain out in Yucca Mountain, and the people in Nevada just went ballistic on them and said, no, can't put your garbage in our backyard. And I'm sitting here saying, why not? How does putting this spent nuclear waste in a mountain in the middle of Nevada going to affect anybody adversely in Reno or Las Vegas? For that matter, what would be the difference if you put the spent nuclear waste in a mountain in Pennsylvania or New Jersey? I mean, you've already got the stuff there, haven't you? It isn't the problem is we need to figure out what we're going to do with it. Well, if you've already got it there, you've already got the problem, haven't you? So if you've already got the problem and you're dealing with it today, why can't you deal with it tomorrow, next year, and more effectively the year after that? Come on, boys and girls. We can build the Panama Canal. We can build the Suez Canal. We can build the trade towers. We can build nuclear aircraft carriers. And we can't figure out what to do with the waste products from a nuclear power plant. You know, when I listen to these kind of lame brain excuses over here, sure, you can't solve the problem with government socialist regulation. That's what your problem is. You're practicing communism over here and having the same problems that the Chinese and the Russians had. It doesn't work. I mean, that's just where reality's at. It didn't work for them, and we're over here complaining because it doesn't work for us. Past accidents. Risk of more in terrorism. Over 360 accidents. Go to www.greenpeace.org. 360 accidents. Last time I heard, there hadn't been any deaths in a nuclear power plant in the United States. None. Zero. Zilch. Now, 40,000 people are killed every year from automobiles. I haven't heard anybody say, my God, we have to abandon automobiles. We have to stop using automobiles because 40,000 people a year get killed. Well, isn't it the oil industry that produces the gasoline to burn in those automobiles that kill 40,000 people a year? Driving an automobile and getting killed in it is one of the hazards of driving, isn't it? I mean, isn't that part of life? I mean, there's hazards in life. Sometimes people fall down the stairs and they get killed. So shouldn't we then abolish all stairs because they're potentially hazardous? I mean, what are we talking about? Putting ourselves into a straitjacket in an insane asylum so that we won't hurt ourselves? I mean, I listen to this kind of crap all the time, and I sit here and I chuckle and I kind of shake my head and I say, my God, you know, where would America be today if we'd have said back in 1860, well, we can't build a transcontinental railroad. Somebody might get hurt out there on the job. Now, we built the Transcontinental Railroad. Thousands of men died in the endeavor, and we did it all without OSHA, the EPA, or the State Tax Commission. And that's what made America great. And it's what makes, or used to make, America great. But now we're a nation that can't even solve our vaccine problem. I mean, you got Americans out here that are so damn incompetent today, they can't even provide a flu shot for themselves. They rely upon government to do it. Government failed them, and they're standing in the streets, standing in lines, crying. Oh, I haven't got a flu shot. I don't know what I'm going to do. And you call this a great nation? A nation made up of people that can't solve a problem as simple as providing a flu shot. Let's think about it. Next year, you're going to have a flu shot again, aren't you, all you people that want to shoot up with snake venom and monkey pus? All right, why don't you plan for that? Go to your doctor and tell him, okay, I couldn't get my flu shot this year. Here's $100, doc. Put it on my account and order a shot for me for next year, 2005, October. I'll be in the 15th of October, 2005, for my flu shot. I'll bet you could provide for your own flu shot and stand a greater chance of success next year than waiting for the government to do it for you. Why don't you try it? Test me on it. Now they say that we got to have many more reactors. Tons of radioactive material would be transported through populated areas. Okay, and I heard that argument, and they said, well, gee, there could be a train wreck in the railroad yards in Chicago, and it would release all of that radioactivity. Can't we solve that problem? I mean, come on. You know, we've got people in this country that graduate from colleges and all these professors with PhDs, you know, piled higher and deeper. Could you transport something that's really nasty, terrible, awful, wicked, I mean really toxic stuff. From New York to Nevada. Could you do that in the United States of America in 2004? In spite of a train wreck. Let's think about this for a minute. We build battleships that have 16 inches of steel in their sides. I mean, that stuff's 16 inches thick. That's pretty thick. And that thing actually floats on water. Now, what if we made a railroad car with 16-inch steel sides? Do you think that that thing could survive a train wreck? I think that you could build a vessel with 16-inch steel sides, drop it from 50,000 feet onto a concrete pad, and it wouldn't break open. I think that's overkill, and I don't think you need to do that, but, you know, just in case you guys are worrywarts and you say, well, if we were going to load up plutonium from Pennsylvania and stick it in a railroad car, yeah, I'll agree with you. If you stuck it in a boxcar, probably, if you had a train wreck, it would get loose. But I think we could build some special radioactive plutonium cars. I mean, it'd be a new type of railroad car called a plutonium car. And you put plutonium in these special 16-inch thick steel cylinders and you load them on a railroad car and you ship it from here to there. I think by the time it got to the Yucca Mountain, I'll bet you wouldn't have more than a couple of those cars involved in a rail car wreck, and then, even then it wouldn't break open, and so then you could solve that problem. Now, I want to remind you that I wear bib overalls and high-top shoes, and I'm just a country boy. And I haven't been to college and I don't have a PhD, but I find it hard to believe that a nation that can send rockets to the moon can't figure out how to ship plutonium from Pennsylvania to Nevada. You mean to tell me you can build a nuclear aircraft carrier, but you can't figure out how to ship a rail car from one side of the continent to the other side of the continent? Well, then, you don't have a right to call yourself the greatest, most technologically advanced nation in the world. Now, the guy that's writing this article here, what about nuclear power? Is nuclear power the solution for the oil crash? Well, it may not be the solution, but could it be part of the solution? Do we have to have one answer, one shoe fits all, or could we have more than one answer? Could it be that wood could play a part? Out in our forests in the United States, out in our forests, is all of this fuel building up. You know, you have to have a permit to go out there and get wood. Don't you think that if people could go out and get that wood free, that they would go out there and take that firewood out of the forest? I mean, it would burn down fewer forests, probably cause fewer wildfires. And could wood fit into the plan in any way? Could oil shale fit into the plan? Could natural gas, hydrogen, solar, wind, hydropower, nuclear power, oil, and coal all working together? Could we do all of that at the same time? Let me give you an illustration. Most of the people around me burn gas. They have propane furnaces and propane stoves. Now, we use propane here to heat our water and cook our food, and then I heat with wood. I mentioned that earlier. Wood plays a part here. And because I burn wood, I consume about 500 gallons of propane less than I would if I burned propane and heated my house. 500 gallons, in round numbers. That's what I would be using every year. That would cost me about $1,000 a year, $2 a gallon. So I save $1,000 a year by burning wood. I burn 5 cords of wood, and the wood costs me probably $20 a cord to make and a little work, and I go out and do it myself. I could buy it for about $500 or about half that. It would be economical even if I bought it. Here's my point. You know, I think a lot more people in America would burn wood if it was available. And wood is growing every day. it's a renewable resource, and it would seem like to me that if you'd open up these forests, instead of closing them up, bureaucratizing them with ranger ricks, and shutting off all of that fuel for its natural consumption, I think that wood would play a part. And you know, every barrel of oil that you save is a barrel of oil that you've earned. You know, a penny saved is a penny earned. Seems like to me the same would apply to oil, wouldn't it? I mean, it's just a view from the country, but why don't you mull that one over a little bit and think about it? Going on here, talking about nuclear energy, they say the nuclear weapons proliferation risk, which would accompany the replacement of fossil fuel with nuclear fission, is staggering. Why? Why is it staggering? The proliferation risk. Let me ask you this. Let's suppose we Americans put in 8,000 nuclear power plants and produced all of this plutonium. Do you mean to tell me that we Americans with 14,000 nuclear weapons are going to go nuts and build 28,000 more nuclear weapons or 56,000 nuclear weapons and that we're just going to proliferate? You mean to tell me that because you produce plutonium out of these nuclear power plants that we have to convert the plutonium into nuclear weapons? I don't see any logic in that kind of an argument. It sounds stupid to me. Just dumb. I can see the argument that people are making as well, that plutonium is highly toxic and takes 24,000 years for its half-life. So it'll be half as toxic in 24,000 years. So in 48,000 years, it'll be one-fourth as toxic and so on down the line. So what? You're going to bury this stuff in a mountain. How many people are going to be going 2 miles deep into Yucca Mountain and getting contaminated from this plutonium? It reminds me of the argument that these environmentalists are using against drilling in the Arctic National Wilderness. How many of you people listening to me right now are going up to the Arctic National Wilderness area to enjoy the pristine wilderness? I never have. I don't plan to, and probably never will. I've got more need for the 6 billion barrels of oil up there than I do for looking at the pristine wilderness. And my question is, why can't we have the wilderness and the oil? Why does it have to be oil or wilderness? Why can't it be oil and wilderness? I mean, just think about it for a second. They're telling us you can have nuclear power or death. Why can't we have nuclear power and life? You can have hydropower or fish, but you can't have both. I'm asking, why can't we have hydropower and fish? Why can't we have wood, shale oil, natural gas, hydrogen, solar, wind, hydro, nuclear, oil, and coal all at the same time? Why does it have to be one or the other? Why does it have to be oil and nothing else? Oil, they tell us, contributes about 40% of the total energy that we use. Well, and that means that 60% of the energy that we use comes from something else. And hydropower has a place. Now, I was just thinking about this the other day. The Colorado River falls a couple thousand feet, doesn't it? I mean, if you take a look up here at the top of the chain in Colorado, it runs down along Highway 70. If you were to put a dam in there, just a little small dam, doesn't have to be a super big one, just a little small dam, about every mile down that river, down Highway 70, I mean, the river falls about, 30, 40 feet to the mile, I would say. And you'd have about 40 feet of head from one dam to the next, and you could be generating electricity all the way down the full length of the Colorado River. I mean, you could have, you know, if you had a dam every mile and the thing is 2,000 miles long and you had, you know, just be reasonable, you know, 500 dams. 500 dams producing a little bit of electricity at each dam. Instead of one gigantic Hoover Dam or Powell, Lake Powell, you had a lot of little ones. And, you know, you stuck a few fish in behind each one of them over there, and it gives you a little recreation and fishing holes all up and down the river. What is it that's so terrible about that idea? You know, these environmentalists come along and says, oh my God, it destroys the pristine wilderness. It just, oh, well, we just can't live with that. I'm sitting here saying, well, why not? Why not? God gave us the earth and he said, dress it and keep it. He gave us a garden, he said, dress it and keep it. He gave us the gold and silver and the minerals in the mountains and he said, now use it. Why is it that we've adopted evolutionary philosophy and all of a sudden the fish are more important than people? Why are fish more important than people? Well, somebody got some demented idea that we're evolving and that we evolved and so the fish are equal to man. Well, that's not what God told us. And I don't believe in evolutionary philosophy. God said that you're superior and I'm going to give you dominance over all the animals. They're there for our use. Doesn't mean that we ought to abuse them or that we ought to abuse the environment. I'm an environmentalist. I have a farm and I take care of soil erosion, but I do it myself. I'm not relying on the government. And I'm in the process of building a solar power plant. I'm going to do what you environmentalists want me to do. Use solar energy. But I'm going to use it at an individual level. And I'm going to solve my own power problem. And if I can solve my power problem and my neighbor Dale can solve his, why can't you solve yours? I think that we can solve the power problem more effectively and more efficiently at the local level, right here at the individual level, than you're going to ever do with central planning from Washington. Now, all you central planners out there, I don't want to get in the way of your happiness and success, but in reading this article here on nuclear power and how nuclear power cannot solve the oil crisis, I would contend with you that it could sure solve a lot of it. And if the Japanese can produce 40% of their power from nuclear energy, and they can solve their nuclear waste disposal problem, and the French can solve their nuclear waste disposal problem and do 60% of their energy needs from nuclear power, we Americans could do the same thing. And when we argue that the Iranians should burn their oil instead of use nuclear power, I think that's short-sighted. I think that the Iranians should save every barrel of oil they can for making gasoline to run their automobiles, and they should generate their electricity from nuclear power. It just makes all the sense in the world to me, but then, of course, I'm just a dummy. Hillbilly without a PhD. Well, the next item over here we ought to take up is natural gas. Can natural gas solve the problem? And throughout this article that Tate sent me, it's one item after another that will not solve the problem. But could it be that taken all together, let's see, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 items, coal, oil, nuclear, hydro, wind, solar, hydrogen, natural gas, shale, oil, and wood. Could all 10 of those sources of energy working together in a free market environment, could they solve the energy crisis? Because 100 years ago they did. That's right, 100 years ago we had no energy crisis. We didn't have an energy crisis until the government got involved. You know, the more regulation that you impose upon people, the greater will be your shortage. You can stand in line, share the shortage, and freeze in the dark with regulation. When the Chinese took the regulations off and loosed the noose around the necks of the Chinese people, they've got an economy growing at 7% a year. Americans are concerned about their economy. Well, take a page right out of the Chinese economy textbook, Economy 101, 7% a year. Hang on, I got to take a break right here. We'll be back with more on energy right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of our population. And the top tax rate was only 7%. Now today, of course, the fears of those early opponents to the income tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. By the time Franklin Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. Now, in 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man. This year, we all had to work until May 12th in order to earn enough to pay our federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make us today? This income tax and social security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, and it violates our English common law as well. And the income tax and social security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and social security is the eighth. That's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? For more information about tax and status, just call 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, just go to the website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Natural gas comes into play. Natural gas is a clean burning fuel. I remember as a kid, 1938, I believe it was, the year before I was born, they drilled a gas well out of Tompkins Hill. And that gas well out there, or the series of gas wells that are out there, have been supplying Eureka, California, and the environs around there from that day to this. It's plentiful. It's cheap. You drill holes in the ground, and you get more of it. I had a student one time that drilled a well up in Pennsylvania, ran his manufacturing plant off of the methane gas coming out of the ground. Here again, these are local solutions. Eureka, California, population 30,000 and a few little towns around there, probably 50, 75,000 people, produce their gas locally. They're not relying upon Prudhoe Bay or someplace else. Furthermore, this guy out in Pennsylvania drilling a hole under his manufacturing plant and pulling methane gas out of those coal seams, he's been doing that now for many, many years. I guess until it runs out, he can continue on. And every day that he runs his plant off of his own methane from under his own ground is barrels of oil that aren't being consumed or imported into the United States. It's natural gas that he's not consuming to run his manufacturing plant that's available for somebody else. Has anybody ever thought about drilling more gas wells in Pennsylvania? You know, when George Gordon cuts wood and I save 500 gallons of propane a year, that's 500 gallons of propane for somebody else, and I'm only burning the dead wood. I'm not cutting down any live trees. I'm burning up the dead wood. That's why I mentioned earlier, you know, wood could play a very valuable part in heating American homes, especially out in areas where there are natural woodlots or natural forests out in the West, for instance, where they have gigantic forest fires every year. Think about all of that energy that's being consumed and wasted when it could be consumed and used productively if we would use our heads, if we would dress and keep the garden instead of trying to politicize it. Natural gas comes into play. the proportion of global energy provided by gas, reported by the U.S. Department of Energy and the International Energy Agency, is about 20% of global energy supply. As a replacement for oil, gas itself will start running out from 2020 on. Demand for natural gas in North America is already outstripping supply, and especially as power utilities take the remaining gas to generate electricity. Gas is not suited for existing jet aircraft, ships, vehicles, and equipment for agriculture and other products. Conversion consumes large amounts of energy as well as money. Natural gas also does not provide the huge array of chemical byproducts that we're so dependent upon. Well, instead of looking at the negative, the glass is half full, why don't we look at the positive? The glass is 20% of global energy supply. If oil is 40% and gas is 20%, and we're running out of gas and oil, then it looks like that we need to start developing other sources. I haven't heard anybody say, look, we're burning up our forests at the rate of about 2 million acres a year. Well, it would seem like to me, and my old granddaddy told me this, that if you'd go out into the forests and cut down the dead wood, cut the limbs up off the ground 20 feet or 30 feet, you could avoid crown fires and the killing of the forest. If you would burn the brush out from underneath those forests like the Indians used to do or natural fire used to do, you wouldn't have all that fuel buildup. We have problems, but we don't have solutions because we have government bureaucracy. They tell us, you've heard this on the news as long as I have, that the ecologists got in here about 50 years ago and said, well, what we want is just natural processes. We don't want to intervene in our forests anymore. So up in Yellowstone, they just let the fires burn until they consumed about half the park. That makes a lot of sense. God told us to dress and keep the garden. Now, there's a natural process that goes on out there, but that doesn't mean that we can't intervene for our own self-interest. Do you mean to tell me that all of those dead trees in Yellowstone Park are a benefit? Well, okay, if that's what you want, is burned up forests, so let me get in the way of your happiness and success. But my common sense says that every one of those burned trees standing up out there in the forest doesn't do anything. But if you'd have cut that tree down, cut it into firewood, and burned it for your heat, like I do, then you could conserve 500 gallons of propane. It makes more sense to me to take that wood that's being wasted anyway on forest fires and then go out and spend billions of dollars a year trying to fight those forest fires and put the fire out. Why don't you use your heads and take that wood and make an industry out of it? It's called the wood industry. Instead of closing up the woods and importing your lumber, why don't you use what you've got? Instead of adding to your balance of payments deficits, why don't you make firewood? Why don't you make lumber in your own forest? Well, you got the ecologists out there protecting the spotted owls. Can't we have spotted owls and lumber? Can't we have spotted owls and wood? Does it have to be one or the other? This, again, is that lobbying. It's the concept that we have that you can have one or the other, but you can't have both. I say that's just nonsense. We had lumber and timber industry, and we had spotted owls. And if there's a problem with the spotted owl population, then let's concentrate on the spotted owl population, but let's not shut all the forests down. Because we have to make a choice between lumber, wood, and spotted owls. Let's have both lumber, wood, and spotted owls. Well, they go on to tell us here that in Canada, production per new well in the Western Basin has slipped from its 1986 peak, and the decline rates are up, and as a result, Canada will have excess pipeline capacity. Well, okay. If Canada has excess pipeline capacity and we're not producing any natural gas in Prudhoe Bay, and we need another pipeline to go alongside. But you know, we can't have that pipeline because we've got the environmentalists. We've got a political lobby. See, we have a political regulation problem. So all that gas up there in Prudhoe Bay gets flared off and it's not usable. You know, it's like burning up your forests at the rate of 2 million acres a year over bad policies. It hasn't dawned on people yet that the environmentalists are destructive. They don't have any constructive solutions. If there is a single constructive solution that's come out of environmentalism, let me know what it is, would you please? Because I haven't heard of any yet. I'm waiting. I hear them tell me that they want to take the dams out of the Columbia River, but I haven't heard anybody say, what are you going to replace it with? They tell us we can't have nuclear energy to replace it. Okay, well then what are you going to use? And then they say, well, we can't use coal because that's... what are you going to... Oh, we're going to use solar and wind. Good, good. Give us a comprehensive plan. How many acres of wind generators does it take to replace Grand Coulee Dam, and where are you going to place them? Could you tell me? How many acres of solar panels is it going to take to replace the dams on the Columbia River or the nuclear power plants that are already producing 20% of our energy? Do I hear these environmentalists saying, well, let's just shut it all down and go back to 1890 when we didn't have electricity? Is that what I'm hearing? How many of you people out there want to do that? How many of you want to go back to 1890? Have you taken a look at North Korea from a satellite image? South Korea is a blazing light, and North Korea is nearly black. No, I don't think that anybody wants to give up their standard of living. I haven't seen any of these greenies walking. They're driving cars like everybody else. They flip on light switches like we all do. Well, I've got a solution here. I'm going to solve George Gordon's energy problem. I'm going to produce my own electricity. And I think you ought to do the same. I remember as a kid, there were 257 sawmills in Humboldt County, California. 237 sawmills, about 1950. Today, there's about six or eight, and they're all big. You know, it used to be that there were lots of little operations producing 2 billion board feet of timber a year. It's a sustainable and renewable resource. And then the environmentalists got in there, and then, of course, big business got in there. And they condensed that down from 237 mills to about 6 or 8, and now it's government-regulated and controlled, and you got the greenies environmentalists in there. And now you've got unemployment up in the Pacific Northwest, and you people out there can't figure out what happened to you, what went wrong. Corporate America is not your friend, and big government's not your friend. When you had little sawmills, you had plenty of employment, plenty of productivity, and no shortages. Now you've got 6 mills, big government, big corporations, you got unemployment, low production, and heavy imports. You know, if we went back to 1900 when we had 237 sawmills, I think we could solve that problem. And now, those 6 or 8 big multinational corporations like Simpson Timber Company and Louisiana Pacific, and see, they own all of the acreage. We've been divorced from the land. We moved to the cities. We wanted jobs, 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 didn't we? So we got jobs, jobs, jobs. Then the corporations bought out the little mills, and then the little mills and their owners took the money and spent it on, you know, whatever it is that they spent it on, cars and fast life and good times. And then the big mills over here now are closing up and locking up the woods with the environmentalists so that they can raise the price of lumber. So we have fewer and fewer jobs. We have higher and higher balance of payments deficits. We now have shortages. We have big government, big business, and now we have big problems in our economy. You know, you do away with the governmental regulations and controls, and you'll do away with about 90% of your problems coming right out of the chute. Now, this article tells us that natural gas is not the solution to the problem. And I'm sitting here saying, well, wait a minute, it can be a part of the solution. If it's 20% of the solution for the problem now, and we added wood to that, and we used our forests, and we burned more wood, we would be using less natural gas, wouldn't we? Just like George Gordon does. I use less propane because I burn wood. Not everybody can burn wood, but the people that can ought to be burning wood rather than burning natural gas, don't you think? And you don't need government to come in here and offer tax incentives. What you need is to get government the hell out of your business so that people can use what's available. You can rest assured that if I could get into the woods, I would go into the woods and cut my fuel. Now, years ago, I can remember 20, 30 years ago, wood used to be free. So people would go out into the national forest, cut their wood for the year and bring it in. Then the government came in with more and more ranger ricks, more and more regulation and control, more and more problems. People said, it's too much work to go out there and do that anyway. For what you save, I'll just burn gas. And so now you've got all this buildup of fuel in the natural forest and 2 million acres burning every year. Ah, come on, guys. Surely people with PhDs can come up with better solutions than that. Or could it be that going to college makes you dumber? Has anybody ever thought of that? Before we had all these college people running around telling us how to live our lives, we had fewer problems. Have you noticed that? Well, if you haven't noticed it, why don't you take a look at it? In 1900, we didn't have very many PhDs, and we didn't have near as many problems. Today, we got lots of PhDs, half of them driving taxi cabs in New York because they haven't got enough other places to put these people to interfere with our economy and interfere with our lives. And now we got more and more problems. We've got problems everywhere. And now they're telling us we're running out of oil. Okay, well, if we're running out of oil and we need that oil for other uses, does it make any sense to you that we should be subsidizing the corn growers to produce a fuel that has 40% of the BTUs? I mean, come on, guys, let's think about it. Here we are paying our tax dollars into our government, and the government, in turn, is paying those tax dollars out to corn growers and ADM to produce this ethanol. If ethanol had a value in the economy, you wouldn't need any tax subsidies because it would be profitable. The reason that you need tax subsidies is because it's unprofitable. It consumes more energy than it produces. And if you reduce the tax dollars to BTUs, that's exactly the equation that tells you that the stuff isn't viable. Now, natural gas is. But it's going to run out in around 2020. Listen, I got a friend down in Texas, a student, and he said, because of all of the environmental controls, it takes us longer to bring new drilling projects online. If you would get out of the way of the little wildcat drillers, they would be out drilling in all kinds of places that would be producing little jags of oil and natural gas here and there, like you saw at Thompson's Hill in Humboldt County, California. There's lots of Thompson's Hills all over America, but you can't drill in them. The people that own them are Exxon. Exxon doesn't want to drill those little places. They just want to keep the other guys from drilling there, because if they drilled there, they would be competitors. Shortages play into the hands of the monopolists. What we want is a monopoly in oil, and they've got it. We want a monopoly in coal, and they've got it. And the monopolists don't want competition. It's the oil and the coal interests that don't want nuclear power. Think about it. Be intelligent. If you were in the oil business, would you want somebody out there producing alternative energy that's going to cut into your sales? Well, as long as you're going to have central planning, you got to have somebody that can tell the oil and the coal interests to sit down and shut up and fold their hands. We're going to use nuclear. We have to conserve the oil. Does it make sense to you to burn oil to generate electricity? Oil, which is the only thing that you can use to produce gasoline, you can produce electricity from coal, you can produce electricity from natural gas, you can produce electricity from water power. Does it make any sense? Now, I used to have a plan here, they still do in some states, they don't in our state, but it's called co-energy. And so out in the West, if you put in a little hydropower plant on your creek and you produced electric power for your ranch, and then you had some extra power, you could tie into the line and they would pay you for that. Do you know how many of those kinds of power plants could be put up in America? Tens of thousands. No, not power plants putting out a megawatt an hour or something, but little power plants that would turn out kilowatts. For instance, we estimated here that if the power company, our local power company, would let us do this, we could put in a steam power plant and produce 25 kW. Now, 25 kW is only enough for about five houses. About 5 kW per house is about what you use if it's a big house. But George Gordon could produce enough power in a steam power plant 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, at the prevailing energy prices today, I could produce enough for 5 people. But it's not encouraged. In fact, it's discouraged. Our energy policy in the United States discourages that. Now, if I could do that, then my neighbors could do that. I figured that I could make about $50,000 a year generating power right here on this farm. I would burn the waste wood on my farm, the dead wood. I would never have to cut a tree. And I could produce 25 kilowatts, not megawatts, now just kilowatts. 5,000 watts per house. 5 houses. I could furnish that much power. But I can't. The power company doesn't want me to do that, number one, because I'd be competing with them, wouldn't I? So the power company doesn't want it. So the power company goes to the legislature and says, we don't want that kind of crap going on in our state. Now, you've got it in Idaho, you've got it in several other states. And of course, I can understand the power company. But meanwhile, we are consuming, you know, we're consuming this electric power that I could be producing, and I'm not producing. So here again, government regulation, it's government getting in the way. Or put another way, if you're going to have central power or central planning, why don't you come up with a plan whereby you require the power companies to take the power from little independent producers. You could probably come up in the United States with 50,000 little producers like George Gordon on 50,000 little power plants putting power into the energy grid, making their living. That would be 50,000 people making their livings. 50,000 less people competing for the scarce jobs out there, producing power, importing less oil from Saudi Arabia to burn in our oil-fired power plants. Why don't we shut down all of the oil-fired and coal-fired power plants and replace those with hydropower, wood power, steam power, and nuclear power in the United States? Why don't we conserve that oil for using in our airliners and our automobiles instead of burning it to make electricity that we can make in 55 other different ways? I mean, I could sit here and think of all kinds of neat ways to do that, but you know, I can't impose that upon people. People have to come to that conclusion of them by themselves. And that's why the free marketplace has always served our interests better than socialism and central planning. Now, we've been practicing the central planning for about 70 years in the United States. We haven't succeeded yet in eradicating the free marketplace. We're trying to. We're working on it. We no doubt will succeed at some indefinite time in the future. But are you really sure that that's what we want to do? This report here that I got from this listener is telling us all the reasons why natural gas cannot replace oil. And I'm sitting here saying, now I can think of all kinds of ways to use natural gas and to increase the production. My student down in Texas tells me that if you just leave him alone, he could go out and find lots of it and make lots of money doing it, and so can thousands of other people, but they're stymied by big oil company lobbies, state and federal regulation, and environmental interests. Now, if the environmentalists are concerned about drilling a hole in the ground, what is it about drilling this hole in the ground to extract natural gas in Texas, Louisiana, or any place else for that matter, going to do to the environment? And then when you write down, here's what it does to the environment that we don't like, then why don't we write that into our law and have government create laws rather than economic roadblocks? And let's go back to when my hole in the ground causes a damage to somebody. When the smoke that's coming off of my flame is damaging the environment, that you come along and find me and say, okay, Gordon, you know, your smoke is drifting off of your property and onto somebody else's, then I will cure my smoke problem. I will stop doing that. It used to be that government was in the business of protecting private property and private property rights. Today, they're in the business of regulating private property and private property rights. I contend that we need to get back to, instead of regulating property and property rights, protecting it. And you'll find when you do that, if you do that, that you can solve your own problem. I've got a student that drilled a hole in the ground and he got his own gas. I have another student in Kentucky that has a gas well that was left over and he's running his greenhouse off of that gas well. If local people at the local level, individuals like George Gordon, I'm going to use solar because I don't have wind. But if you've got wind in Nebraska and you can produce your own power, why don't you produce your own power? You ranchers and farmers, cut yourself off the grid. It's a wild new concept. Solve your own problem and do it with property and property rights instead of government and central planning. I'll bet you you'll make more money doing it. And you'll be doing the central planners and the rest of the people in the country a big favor in the process. I contend that coal, oil, nuclear, hydro, wind, solar, hydrogen, natural gas, shale, oil, and wood, all working together, is a better plan at the local level with property and property rights to solve the problem. All right, I got to take a break here. We'll see you tomorrow night, same time, same station. We'll talk about hydroelectric and coal, liquid fuels from coal. There are other solutions to the problem besides either or. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about The Law Hour and The Law School, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. There's the signal. My time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.